131. This is the third tape. Chapter 5. Some Results of Initiation. One of the fundamental principles of true spiritual science is that the one who devotes himself to its study should do so with full consciousness. He should attempt nothing and practice nothing without knowledge of the effect produced. A teacher of spiritual science who gives advice or instruction will at the same time always explain to those striving for higher knowledge the effects produced on body, soul, and spirit, if his advice and instructions be followed. Some effects produced upon the soul of the student will here be indicated, for only those who know such things as they are here communicated can undertake in full consciousness the exercises that lead to knowledge of the higher worlds. Without the latter, no genuine esoteric training is possible, for it must be understood that all groping in the dark is discouraged, and that failure to pursue this training with open eyes may lead to mediumship, but not the exact clairvoyance in the sense of spiritual science. The exercises described in the preceding chapters, if practiced in the right way, involve certain changes in the organism of the soul or astral body. The latter is only perceptible to the clairvoyant, and may be compared to a cloud, psycho-spiritually luminous to a certain degree, in the center of which the physical body is discernible. Parenthesis, a description will be found in the author's book, Theosophy. Parenthesis. In this astral body, desires, lusts, passions, and ideas become visible in a spiritual way. Sensual appetites, for instance, create the impression of a dark red radiance with a definite shape. A pure and noble thought finds its expression in a reddish-violet radiance. The clear-cut concept of the logical thinker is experienced as a yellowish figure with sharply defined outline. The confused thought of the muddled head appears as a figure with vague outline. The thoughts of a person with one-sided queer views appear sharply outlined but immobile, while the thoughts of people accessible to the points of view of others are seen to be mobile, changeable outlines. Parenthesis. In all these and the following descriptions, it must be noted that by seeing a color, spiritually seeing is meant. When the clairvoyant speaks of seeing red, he means, I have an experience in a psycho-spiritual way which is equivalent to the physical experience when an impression of red is received, unquote. This mode of expression is here used because it is perfectly natural to the clairvoyant. If this point is overlooked, a mere color vision may easily be mistaken for a genuine clairvoyant experience. End of parenthesis. The further the student advances in his inner development, the more regular will be the differentiation within his astral body. The latter is confused and undifferentiated in the case of a person of undeveloped inner life. Yet the clairvoyant can perceive even the unorganized astral body as a figure standing out distinctly from its environment. It extends from the center of the head to the middle of the physical body and appears like an independent body possessing certain organs. The organs now to be considered are perceptible to the clairvoyant near the following parts of the physical body. The first, between the eyes. The second, near the larynx. The third, in the region of the heart. The fourth, in the so-called pit of the stomach. The fifth and sixth are situated in the abdomen. These organs are technically known as wheels, chakrams, or lotus flowers. They are so called on account of their likeness to wheels or flowers. But of course it should be clearly understood that such an expression is not to be applied more literally than is the term wings when referring to the two halves of the lungs. Just as there is no question of wings in the case of the lungs, so too in the case of the lotus flowers, the expression must be taken figuratively. In undeveloped persons, these lotus flowers are dark in color, motionless, and inert. In the clairvoyant, however, they are luminous, mobile, and of variegated color. Something of this kind applies to the medium, though in a different way. This question, however, need not be pursued here any further. Now, when the student begins his exercises, the lotus flowers become more luminous. Later on, they begin to revolve. When this occurs, clairvoyance begins, for these flowers are the sense organs of the soul, and their revolutions express the fact that the clairvoyant perceives supersensibly. What was said previously concerning spiritual seeing applies equally to these revolutions and even to the lotus flowers themselves. No one can perceive the supersensible until he has developed his astral senses in this way. Thanks to the spiritual organ situated in the vicinity of the larynx, it becomes possible to survey clairvoyantly the thoughts and mentality of other beings, and to obtain a deeper insight into the true laws of natural phenomena. The organ situated near the heart permits of clairvoyant knowledge of the sentiments and disposition of other souls. When developed, this organ also makes it possible to observe certain deeper forces in animals and plants. By means of the organ in the so-called pit of the stomach, knowledge is acquired of the talents and capacities of souls. By its means, too, the part played by animals, plants, stones, metals, atmospheric phenomena, and so on, in the household of nature becomes apparent. The organ in the vicinity of the larynx has 16 petals, or spokes, the one in the region of the heart, 12, and the one in the pit of the stomach, 10. Now, certain activities of the soul are connected with the development of these organs, and anyone devoting himself to them in a certain definite way contributes something to the development of the corresponding organs. In the 16-petaled lotus, 8 of its 16 petals were developed in the remote past during an earlier stage of human evolution. Man himself contributed nothing to this development. He received them as a gift from nature, at a time when his consciousness was in a dull, dreamy condition. At that stage of human evolution, they were in active use, but the manner of their activity was only compatible with that dull state of consciousness. As consciousness became clearer and brighter, the petals became obscured and ceased their activity. Man himself can now develop the remaining 8 petals by means of conscious exercises, and thereby the whole lotus flower becomes luminous and mobile. The acquisition of certain faculties depends on the development of each one of the 16 petals. Yet, as already shown, only 8 can be consciously developed. The remainder then appear of their own accord. The development proceeds in the following manner. The student must first apply himself with care and attention to certain functions of the soul hitherto exercised by him in a careless and inattentive manner. There are 8 such functions. The first is the way in which ideas and conceptions are acquired. In this respect, people usually allow themselves to be led by chance alone. They see or hear one thing or another and form their ideas accordingly. As long as this is the case, the 16 petals of the lotus flower remain ineffective. It is only when the student begins to take his self-education in hand in this respect that the petals become effective. His ideas and conceptions must be guarded. Each single idea should acquire significance for him. He should see in it a definite message instructing him concerning the things of the outer world, and he should derive no satisfaction from ideas devoid of such significance. He must govern his mental life so that it becomes a true mirror of the outer world, and direct his effort to the exclusion of incorrect ideas from his soul. The second of these functions is concerned with the control of resolutions. The student must not resolve upon even the most trifling act without well-founded and thorough consideration. Thoughtless and meaningless actions should be foreign to his nature. He should have well-considered grounds for everything he does, and abstain from everything to which no significant motive urges him. The third function concerns speech. The student should utter no word that is devoid of sense and meaning. All talking for the sake of talking draws him away from his path. He must avoid the usual kind of conversation, with its promiscuous discussion of indiscriminately varied topics. This does not imply his preclusion from intercourse with his fellows. It is precisely in such intercourse that his conversation should develop to significance. He is ready to converse with everyone, but he does so thoughtfully and with thorough deliberation. He never speaks without grounds for what he says. He seeks to use neither too many nor too few words. The fourth is the regulation of outward action. The student tries to adjust his actions in such a way that they harmonize with the actions of his fellow men and with the events in his environment. He refrains from actions which are disturbing to others and in conflict with his surroundings. He seeks to adjust his actions so that they combine harmoniously with his surroundings and with his position in life. when an external motive causes him to act, he considers how he can best respond. When the impulse proceeds from himself, he weighs with minute care the effects of his activity. The fifth function includes the management of the whole of life. The student endeavors to live in conformity with both nature and the spirit. Never over hasty, he is also never indolent. Excessive activity and laziness are equally alien to him. He looks upon life as a means for work and disposes it accordingly. He regulates his habits and the care of his health in such a way that a harmonious whole is the outcome. The sixth is concerned with human endeavor. The student tests his capacities and proficiency and conducts himself in the light of such self-knowledge. He attempts nothing beyond his powers, yet seeks to omit nothing within their scope. On the other hand, he sets himself aims that have to do with the ideals and the great duties of a human being. He does not mechanically regard himself as a wheel in the vast machinery of mankind, but seeks to comprehend the tasks of his life and to look out beyond the limit of the daily and trivial. He endeavors to fulfill his obligations ever better and more perfectly. The seventh deals with the effort to learn as much from life as possible. Nothing passes before the student without giving him occasion to accumulate experience which is of value to him for life. If he has performed anything wrongly or imperfectly, he lets this be an incentive for meeting the same contingency later on, rightly and perfectly. When others act, he observes them with the same end in view. He tries to gather a rich store of experience, ever returning to it for counsel. Nor indeed will he ever do anything without looking back on experiences from which he can derive help in his decisions and affairs. Finally, the eighth is as follows. The student must, from time to time, glance introspectively into himself, sink back into himself, take counsel with himself, form and test the fundamental principles of his life, run over in his thoughts the sum total of his knowledge, weigh his duties, and reflect upon the content and aim of life. All these things have been mentioned in the preceding chapters. Here they are merely recapitulated in connection with the development of the 16-petaled lotus. By means of these exercises, the latter will become ever more and more perfect, for it is upon such exercises that the development of clairvoyance depends. The better the student's thoughts and speech harmonize with the processes in the outer world, the more quickly will he develop this faculty. Whoever thinks and speaks what is contrary to truth destroys something in the germ of his 16-petaled lotus. Truthfulness, uprightness, and honesty are in this connection creative forces, while mendacity, deceitfulness, and dishonesty are destructive forces. The student must realize, however, that actual deeds are needed and not merely good intentions. If I think or say anything that does not conform with reality, I kill something in my spiritual organs, even though I believe my intentions to be ever so good. It is here as with the child, which needs must burn itself when it touches fire, even though it did so out of ignorance. The regulation of the above activities of the soul in the manner described causes the 16-petaled lotus to shine in glorious hues and imparts to it a definite movement. Yet it must be noted that the faculty of clairvoyance cannot make its appearance before a definite degree of development of the soul has been reached. It cannot appear as long as it is irksome for the student to regulate his life in this manner. He is still unfit as long as the activities described above are a matter of special preoccupation for him. The first traces of clairvoyance only appear when he has reached the point of being able to live in the specified way as a person habitually lives. These things must then no longer be laborious, but must have become a matter of course. There must be no need for him to be continually watching himself and urging himself on to live in this way. It must all have become a matter of habit. Now this lotus flower may be made to develop in another way by following certain other instructions. But all such methods are rejected by true spiritual science, for they lead to the destruction of physical health and to moral ruin. They are easier to follow than those here described. The latter, though protracted and difficult, lead to the true goal and cannot but strengthen morally. The distorted development of a lotus flower results not only in illusions and fantastic conceptions, should a certain degree of clairvoyance be acquired, but also in errors and instability in ordinary life. Such a development may be the cause of timidity, envy, vanity, haughtiness, willfulness, and so on in a person who hitherto was free from these defects. It has already been explained that 8 of the 16 petals of this lotus flower were developed in a remote past, and that these will reappear of themselves in the course of esoteric development. All the effort and attention of the student must be devoted to the remaining 8. Faulty training may easily result in the reappearance of the earlier petals alone, while the new petals remain stunted. This will ensue especially if too little logical, rational thinking is employed in the training. It is of supreme importance that the student should be a rational and clear-thinking person, and of further importance that he should practice the greatest clarity of speech. People who begin to have some presentiment of supersensible things are apt to wax talkative on this subject, thereby retarding their normal development. The less one talks about these matters, the better. Only someone who has achieved a certain degree of clarity should speak about them. At the beginning of their instruction, students are, as a rule, astonished at the teacher's lack of curiosity concerning their own experiences. It would be much better for them to remain entirely silent on this subject, and to content themselves with mentioning only whether they have been successful or unsuccessful in performing the exercises and observing the instructions given them. For the teacher has quite other means of estimating their progress than the student's own statements. The 8 petals now under consideration always become a little hardened through such statements, whereas they should be kept soft and supple. The following example taken, for the sake of clarity, not from the supersensible world, but from ordinary life, will illustrate this point. Suppose I hear a piece of news, and thereupon immediately form an opinion. Shortly afterwards I receive some further news which does not tally with the previous information. I am thereby obliged to reverse my previous judgment. The result is an unfavorable influence upon my 16-petal lotus. Quite the contrary would have been the case had I, in the first place, suspended judgment, and remained silent both inwardly in thought and outwardly in word concerning the whole affair, until I had acquired reliable grounds for forming my judgment. Caution in the formation and pronouncement of judgments becomes, by degrees, the special characteristic of the student. On the other hand, his receptivity for impressions and experiences increases. He lets them pass over him silently, so as to collect and have the largest possible number of facts at his disposal when the time comes to form his opinions. Bluish-red and reddish-pink shades color the lotus flower as the result of such circumspection, whereas, in the opposite case, dark red and orange shades appear. Students will recognize in the conditions attached to the development of the 16-petaled lotus the instructions given by the Buddha to his disciples for the path. Yet there is no question here of teaching Buddhism, but of describing conditions governing development, which are the natural outcome of spiritual science. The fact that these conditions correspond with certain teachings of the Buddha is no reason for not finding them true in themselves. The 12-petal lotus, situated in the region of the heart, is developed in a similar way. Half its petals, too, were already existent and in active use in a remote stage of human evolution. Hence these 6 petals need not now be especially developed in esoteric training. They appear of themselves and begin to revolve when the student sets to work on the other 6. Here again he learns to promote this development by consciously controlling and directing certain inner activities in a special way. It must be clearly understood that the perceptions of each single organ of soul or spirit bear a different character. The 12 and 16-petaled lotus flowers transmit quite different perceptions. The latter, 16 that is, perceives forms, the thoughts and mentality of other beings, and the laws governing natural phenomena become manifest through the 16-petaled lotus as figures, not rigid, motionless figures, but mobile forms filled with life. The clairvoyant in whom this sense is developed can describe for every mode of thought and for every law of nature a form which expresses them. A revengeful thought, for example, assumes an arrow-like pronged form, while a kindly thought is often formed like an opening flower, and so on. Clear-cut, significant thoughts are regular and symmetrical in form, while confused thoughts have wavy outlines. Quite different perceptions are received through the 12-petaled lotus. These perceptions may, in a sense, be likened to warmth and cold, as applied to the soul. A clairvoyant equipped with this faculty feels this warmth and cold streaming out from the forms discerned by the 16-petaled lotus. Had he developed the 16 and not the 12-petaled lotus, he would only perceive, in the kindly thought, for instance, the figure described above, while a clairvoyant in whom both senses were developed would also notice what can only be described as soul warmth flowing from the thought. It should be noted in passing that esoteric training never develops one organ without the other, so that the above-mentioned example may be regarded as a hypothetical case in behalf of clarity. The 12-petaled lotus, when developed, reveals to the clairvoyant a deep understanding of the processes of nature. Rays of soul warmth issue from every manifestation of growth and development, while everything in the process of decay, destruction, ruin, gives an impression of cold. The development of this sense may be furthered in the following manner. To begin with, the student endeavors to regulate his sequence of thought, that is, control of thought. Just as the 16-petaled lotus is developed by cultivating thoughts that conform with truth and are significant, so too the 12-petaled lotus is developed by inwardly controlling the trains of thought. Thoughts that dart to and fro like will-o'-the-wisps and follow each other in no logical or rational sequence, but merely by pure chance, destroy its form. The closer thought is made to follow upon thought, and the more strictly everything of illogical nature is avoided, the more suitable will be the form this sense organ develops. If the student hears illogical thoughts, he immediately lets the right thoughts pass through his mind. He should not, however, withdraw in a loveless way from what is perhaps an illogical environment in order to further his own development. Neither should he feel himself impelled to correct all the illogical thoughts expressed around him. He should rather silently coordinate the thoughts as they pour in upon him and make them conform to logic and sense, and at the same time endeavor in every case to retain this same method in his own thinking. An equal consistency in his actions forms the second requirement, that is, control of actions. All inconstancy, all disharmony of action is baneful for the lotus flower here in question. When the student performs some action, he must see to it that his succeeding action follows in logical sequence. For if he acts from day to day with variable intent, he will never develop the faculty here considered. The third requirement is the cultivation of endurance, that is, perseverance. The student is impervious to all influences which would divert him from the goal he has set himself, as long as he can regard it as the right goal. For him, obstacles contain a challenge that impels him to surmount them, but never a reason for giving up. The fourth requirement is forbearance or tolerance toward persons, creatures, and also circumstances. The student suppresses all superfluous criticism of everything that is imperfect, evil, and bad, and seeks rather to understand everything that comes under his notice. Even as the sun does not withdraw its light from the bad and the evil, so he too does not refuse them an intelligent sympathy. Should some trouble befall him, he does not proceed to condemn and criticize, but accepts the inevitable and endeavors to the best of his ability to give the matter a turn for the best. He does not consider the opinions of others merely from his own standpoint, but seeks to put himself into the other's position. The fifth requirement is impartiality toward everything that life brings. In this connection, we speak of faith and trust. The student meets every human being and every creature with this trust and lets it inspire his every action. Upon hearing some information, he never says to himself, "I don't believe it, it contradicts my present opinions." He is far rather ready to to test and rectify his views and opinions. He ever remains receptive for everything that confronts him, and he trusts in the efficacy of his undertakings. Timidity and skepticism are banished from his being. He harbors a faith in the power of his intentions. 100 failures cannot rob him of this faith. This is the, quote, faith which can move mountains, unquote. The 6th requirement is the cultivation of a certain inner balance or equanimity. The student endeavors to retain his composure in the face of joy and sorrow, and eradicates the tendency to fluctuate between the 7th heaven of joy and the depths of despair. Misfortune and danger, fortune and advancement, alike find him ready armed. The reader will recognize in the qualities here described the 6 attributes which the candidate for initiation strives to acquire. The intention has been to show their connection with the spiritual organ known as the 12-petaled lotus flower. As before, special instructions can be given to bring this lotus flower to fruition, but here again the perfect symmetry of its form depends on the development of the qualities mentioned, the neglect of which results in this organ being formed into a caricature of its proper shape. In this case, should a certain clairvoyance be attained, the qualities in question may take an evil instead of a good direction. A person may become intolerant, timid, or contentious toward his environment, may, for instance, acquire some feeling for the sentiments of others, and for this reason shun them or hate them. This may even reach the point where, by reason of the inner coldness that overwhelms him, when he hears repugnant opinions, he is unable to listen, or he may behave in an objectionable manner. The development of this organ may be accelerated if, in addition to all that has been stated, certain other injunctions are observed, which can only be imparted to the student by word of mouth. Yet the instructions given above do not actually lead to genuine esoteric training, and moreover, the regulation of life in the way described can be advantageous to all who cannot or will not undergo esoteric training, for it does not fail to produce an effect upon the organism of the soul, even though slowly. As regards the esoteric student, the observance of these principles is indispensable. Should he attempt esoteric training without conforming to them, this could only result in his entering the higher worlds with inadequate organs, and instead of perceiving the truth, he would be subject to deceptions and illusions. He would attain a certain clairvoyance, but for the most part be the victim of greater blindness than before. Formerly, he at least stood firmly within the physical world. Now he looks beyond this physical world and grows confused about it before acquiring a firm footing in a higher world. All power of distinguishing truth from error would then perhaps fail him, and he would entirely lose his way in life. It is just for this reason that patience is so necessary in these matters. It must ever be borne in mind that the instructions given in esoteric training may go no further than is compatible with the willing readiness shown to develop the lotus flowers to their regular shape. Should these flowers be brought to fruition before they have quietly attained their correct form, mere caricatures would be the result. Their maturity can be brought about by the special instructions given in esoteric training, but their form is dependent on the method of life described above. An inner training of a particularly intimate character is necessary for the development of the 10-petaled lotus flower, for it is now a question of learning consciously to control and dominate the sense impressions themselves. This is of particular importance in the initial stages of clairvoyance, for it is only by this means that a source of countless illusions and fancies is avoided. People, as a rule, do not realize by what factors their sudden ideas and memories are dominated and how they are produced. Consider the following case. Someone is traveling by railway. His mind is busy with one thought. Suddenly his thought diverges. He recollects an experience that befell him years ago and interweaves it with his present thought. He did not notice that in looking through the window he had caught sight of a person who resembled another intimately connected with the recollected experience. He remains conscious not of what he saw, but of the effect it produced, and thus believes that it all came to him of its own accord. How much in life occurs in such a way! How great is the part played in our life by things we hear and learn, without our consciously realizing the connection. Someone, for instance, cannot bear a certain color, but does not realize that this is due to the fact that the schoolteacher who used to worry him many years ago wore a coat of that color. Innumerable illusions are based upon such associations. Many things leave their mark upon the soul while remaining outside the pale of consciousness. The following may occur. Someone reads in the paper about the death of a well-known person, and forthwith claims to have had a presentiment of it yesterday, although he had neither heard nor seen anything that might have given rise to such a thought. And indeed it is quite true that the thought occurred to him yesterday, as though of its own accord, that this particular person would die. Only one thing escaped his attention. 2 or 3 hours before this thought occurred to him yesterday, he went to visit an acquaintance. A newspaper lay on the table. He did not actually read it, but his eyes unconsciously fell on the announcement of the dangerous illness of the person in question. He remained unconscious of the impression he had received, and yet this impression resulted in his presentiment. Reflection upon these matters will show how great is the source of illusion and fantasy contained in such associations. It is just this source which must be dammed up by all who seek to develop their 10-petaled lotus flower. Deeply hidden characteristics in other souls can be perceived by this organ, but their truth depends on the attainment of immunity from the above-mentioned illusions. For this purpose it is necessary that the student should control and dominate everything that seeks to influence him from outside. He should reach the point of really receiving no impressions beyond those he wishes to receive. This can only be achieved by the development of a powerful inner life. By an effort of the will, he only allows such things to impress him to which his attention is directed, and he actually evades all impressions to which he does not voluntarily respond. If he sees something, it is because he wills to see it, and if he does not voluntarily take notice of something, it is actually non-existent for him. The greater the energy and inner activity devoted to this work, the more extensively will this faculty be attained. The student must avoid all vacuous gazing and mechanical listening. For him only those things exist to which he turns his eye or his ear. He must practice the power of hearing nothing, even in the greatest disturbance, if he does not will to hear it. And he must make his eyes unimpressionable to things of which he does not particularly take notice. He must be shielded as by an inner armor against all unconscious impressions. In this connection, the student must devote special care to his thought life. He singles out a particular thought and endeavors to link with it only such other thoughts as he can himself consciously and voluntarily produce. He rejects all casual ideas and does not connect this thought with another until he has investigated the origin of the latter. He goes still further. If, for instance, he feels a particular antipathy for something, he will combat it and endeavor to establish a conscious relation between himself and the thing in question. In this way, the unconscious elements that intrude into his soul will become fewer and fewer. Only by such severe self-discipline can the 10-petaled lotus flower attain its proper form. The student's inner life must become a life of attention, and he must learn really to hold at a distance everything to which he should not or does not wish to direct his attention. If this strict self-discipline be accompanied by meditation, as described in esoteric training, the lotus flower in the region of the pit of the stomach comes to maturity in the right way, and light and color of a spiritual kind are now added to the form and warmth perceptible to the organs described above. The talents and faculties of other beings are thereby revealed, also the forces and the hidden attributes of nature. The colored aura of living creatures then becomes visible. All that is around us manifests its spiritual attributes. It must be understood that the very greatest care is necessary at this stage of development, for the play of unconscious memories is here exceedingly active. If this were not the case, many people would possess this inner sense, for it comes almost immediately into evidence when the impressions delivered by the outer senses are held so completely under control that they become dependent on nothing save attention or inattention. This inner sense remains ineffective as long as the powerful outer senses smother and benumb it. Still greater difficulty attends the development of the 6-petaled lotus flower, situated in the center of the body, for it can only be achieved as the result of complete mastery and control of the whole personality through consciousness of self, so that body, soul, and spirit form one harmonious whole. The functions of the body, the inclinations and passions of the soul, the thoughts and ideas of the spirit, must be tuned to perfect unison. The body must be so ennobled and purified that its organs incite to nothing that is not in the service of the soul and spirit. The soul must not be impelled through the body to lusts and passions which are antagonistic to pure and noble thought. Yet the spirit must not stand like a slave driver over the soul, dominating it with laws and commandments. The soul must rather learn to obey these laws and duties out of its own free inclination. The student must not feel duty to be an oppressive power to which he unwillingly submits, but rather something which he performs out of love. His task is to develop a free soul that maintains equilibrium between body and spirit, and he must perfect himself in this way to the extent of being free to abandon himself to the functions of the senses, for these should be so purified that they lose the power to drag him down to their level. He must no longer require to curb his passions, inasmuch as they are of their own accord, follow the good. So long as self-chastisement is necessary, no one can pass a certain stage of esoteric development, for a virtue practiced under constraint is futile. If there is any lust remaining, it interferes with esoteric development, however great the effort made not to humor it. Nor does it matter whether this desire proceeds from the soul or the body. For example, if a certain stimulant be avoided for the purpose of self-purification, this deprivation will only prove helpful if the body suffers no harm from it. Should the contrary be the case, this proves that the body craves the stimulant and that abstinence from it is of no value. In this case, it may actually be a question of renouncing the ideal to be attained until more favorable physical conditions, perhaps in another life, shall be forthcoming. A wise renunciation may be a far greater achievement than the struggle for something which, under given conditions, remains unattainable. Indeed, a renunciation of this kind contributes more toward development than the opposite course. The six-petal lotus flower, when developed, permits of intercourse with beings of higher worlds, though only when their existence is manifested in the astral or soul world. The development of this lotus flower, however, is not advisable unless the student has made great progress on that path of esoteric development which enables him to raise his spirit into a still higher world. This entry into the spiritual world proper must always run parallel with the development of the lotus flowers, otherwise the student will fall into error and confusion. He would undoubtedly be able to see, but he would remain incapable of forming a correct estimate of what he saw. Now, the development of the six-petaled lotus flower itself provides a certain security against confusion and instability, for no one can be easily confused who has attained perfect equilibrium between sense, that or body, passion, or soul, and idea, or spirit. And yet something more than this security is required, when through the development of the six-petaled lotus flower, living beings of independent existence are revealed to his spirit, beings belonging to a world so completely different from the world known to his physical senses. The development of the lotus flowers alone does not assure sufficient security in these higher worlds. Still higher organs are necessary. The latter will now be described before the remaining lotus flowers and the further organization of the soul-body are discussed. Parenthesis. This expression, soul-body, although obviously contradictory when taken literally, is used because to clairvoyant perception the impression received spiritually corresponds to the impression received physically when the physical body is perceived. Parenthesis. The development of the soul body in the manner described above permits of perception in a supersensible world, but anyone wishing to find his way in this world must not remain stationary at this stage of development. The mere mobility of the lotus flowers is not sufficient. The student must acquire the power of regulating and controlling the movement of his spiritual organs independently and with complete consciousness. Otherwise he would become a plaything for external forces and powers. To avoid this he must acquire the faculty of hearing what is called the inner word, and this involves the development not only of the soul body, but also of the etheric body The latter is that tenuous body revealed to the clairvoyant as a kind of double of the physical body, and forms to a certain extent an intermediate step between the soul nature and the physical body. (See the description in the author's book, Theosophy). It is possible for one equipped with clairvoyant powers consciously to suggest away the physical body of a person. This corresponds on a higher plane to an exercise in attentiveness on a lower plane. Just as a person can divert his attention from something in front of him so that it becomes non-existent for him, the clairvoyant can extinguish a physical body from his field of observation so that it becomes physically transparent to him. If he exerts this faculty in the case of some person standing before him, there remains visible to his clairvoyant sight only the etheric body, besides the soul body, which is larger than the other two, etheric and physical bodies, and interpenetrates them both. The etheric body has approximately the size and form of the physical body, so that it practically fills the same space. It is an extremely delicate and finely organized structure. (I beg the physicist not to be disturbed at the expression etheric body. The word ether here is merely used to suggest the fineness of the body in question, and need not in any way be connected with the hypothetical ether of physics. Its ground color is different from any of the seven colors contained in the rainbow. Anyone capable of observing it will find a color which is actually non-existent for sense perception, but to which the color of young peach blossom may be comparable. If desired, the etheric body can be examined alone. For this purpose, the soul body must be extinguished by an effort of attentiveness in the manner described above. Otherwise, the etheric body will present an ever-changing picture owing to its interpenetration by the soul body. Now, the particles of the etheric body are in continual motion. Countless currents stream through it in every direction. By these currents, life itself is maintained and regulated. Every body that has life, including animals and plants, possesses an etheric body. Even minerals, traces of it can be observed. These currents and movements are, to begin with, independent of human will and consciousness, just as the action of the heart or stomach is beyond our jurisdiction. And this independence remains unaltered so long as we do not take our development in hand in the sense of acquiring supersensible faculties. For, at a certain stage, development consists precisely in adding to the unconscious currents and movements of the etheric body others that are consciously produced and controlled. When esoteric development has progressed so far that the lotus flowers begin to stir, much has already been achieved by the student, which can result in the formation of certain quite definite currents and movements in his etheric body. The object of this development is the formation of a kind of center in the region of the physical heart, from which radiate currents and movements in the greatest possible variety of colors and forms. The center is in reality not a mere point, but a most complicated structure, a most wonderful organ. It glows and shimmers with every shade of color and displays forms of great symmetry, capable of rapid transformation. Other forms and streams of color radiate from this organ to the other parts of the body, and beyond it to the astral body, completely permeating and illuminating it. The most important of these currents flow to the lotus flowers. They permeate each petal and regulate its revolutions. Then, streaming out at the points of the petals, they lose themselves in outer space. The higher the development of a person, the greater the circumference to which these rays extend. I'm on page 166. I will begin the first paragraph on that page on the other side. So I'm up to page 166 on this.